Progress is supposed to be a given in modern human society. We expect our technology to advance year over year, and for maintaining that pace, we rely on Moore's Law. In other words, last year's model is always obsolete. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. One way to distinguish 21st century technology over that from other eras is that processing power is personal power. Throughout the 20th century, freedom of the press belonged to those who owned one. In 2016, citizen journalists and citizen publishers have ascended. The transformation of communication is hardly complete, though. As I learned over the last 12 months, progress is not a straight line. When students fan out on campus for class, chances are good they aren't carrying laptops, but smartphones instead. And they aren't alone in looking to the ubiquitous devices to enhance learning. Faculty, too, have high hopes for handhelds. Educator and editor Michael Greer says if we are ever going to make learning mobile, we must rethink learning. In a blog post for the Textbook and Academic Authors Association, he argued that technology should serve learning, not drive it. Michael Greer teaches online courses in editing and publishing at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and is editor for the journal Research in Online Literacy Education. He is also a frequent guest on Beyond the Book.
The conceptual shift that I think I'm talking about is from one model of learning to another. And the existing model of learning that has driven a lot of technology is what I would call the content delivery model. The idea that a student is kind of a passive receptacle sitting at a desk, downloading information to her brain. And the newer conceptual model that I think we need to move toward is a kind of a learning experience model, or what educational psychologists and ed theorists would call a constructivist model. Now, this is a very old idea. I'm not saying anything that's new or groundbreaking to anybody who's ever taken even an intro level ed psych course. We've known for many, many years that learners are not empty vessels waiting to be filled with knowledge. But when you look at the way platforms and digital labs and digital spaces like Blackboard, they're built as if we were still in this content delivery model, that the student watches a video and somehow that knowledge is magically transferred to her brain and now she can pass the quiz and move on to the next video. So this conceptual shift is really to look at the student or the learner as constructing meaning and making connections between new ideas and what they already know. That's the way learning really happens. And I think that shift is a challenge for many people to make who have never really sat down to think about the science of learning or pedagogy or educational theory. But kind of now is the time to, we're really being prompted by the technology to have to do that.
In journalism, digital technology with its capacity for two-way interaction is also driving a transformation in the relationship between readers and reporters. Communities and conversations form naturally around digital journalism. Mostly, though, they are confined to comment sections on news sites. Journalists and audiences today are only just shouting at each other. Jane Friedhoff is a game designer, creative researcher, and experimental programmer whose work focuses on experimenting with media forms in order to create new, unusual, and even playful relationships between people. While working as a creative technologist at the New York Times R&D lab, she developed an interactive journalism model.
The nature of R&D is that it's projected into the future, right? And you're able to fail and you can learn from failure. And that's valuable on its own. And, you know, it was definitely like you had to be mindful when you went down to the newsroom to understand that these people are on intense deadlines. Failing publicly is like a very different beast. And so you have to take all that stuff into account. Again, the not steamrolling type of thing.
Right. And so the experiment that you did to engage in that newsroom was what you call membrane. It was an attempt to create something called permeable publishing. Mm-hmm. So tell us what that is.
Sure. So membrane, is a sort of experiment in the way that we can write using digital text. And the idea of permeable publishing is this idea of a reading experience where there's not just like a wall between the author and the reader, right? Typically, you have some sort of web page or an article. Maybe there's a comment section. That comment section is, you know, down below or off to the side. It's not necessarily really linked in a way to the source material. And it's a very particular kind of interaction. You know, it's sort of two-way. Maybe the author comes into the comments, but it feels like it's happening somewhere else. So it still kind of feels walled off. And what I was interested in, and this was actually very much informed by my, like, game design practice, was how we can create holes in that wall, how we can start to make it more of like a membrane, so to speak, and allow things to flow back and forth and kind of have commenters influence writers, influence commenters, and back and forth.
So how did you create that then? And sort of the vision, the image is of a tree that branches along as it grows and grows and grows. Tell us how that really works in practice.
So in practice, the way that it happens is an author writes some sort of article. It can be anything. It's not really determined. There's no subject matter requirement. Once they write that article, they can think about what kinds of questions they're open to being asked. So, you know, maybe if you're a reporter, let's just say you want to do the classic who, what, when, where, why. You know, if you have a special interest blog or something else, you know, maybe it's a cooking blog. So you want people to be able to ask, you know, what could I substitute here? You know, is it Celsius or Fahrenheit? Whatever. So you sort of say what questions you're open to answering. And then when your readers arrive at your site, they can, as they read through the article, highlight any piece of text, any length, doesn't matter, and choose a question from one of those dropdowns. So for example, if you've written an article about a particular war, a reader could, you know, highlight a person's name and ask, who is this? Or highlight a past event that you reference that maybe you thought everyone had the same background information on and say, what was that? Then the writer can go on their sort of admin end. They can go see the list of questions that people have asked and kind of batch reply. So if, you know, if they happen to notice, wow, you know, 50 people asked who this person was, I should probably give more background on that. They can select all of those questions and sort of write one answer to them, which is then embedded on the front end. So any reader who comes after that will see that term or name or phrase highlighted. They can click on it and see the author's description right in the page. So everything is really centralized. All the questions are really answered right around where they're asked. And it's just a way that authors and commenters can sort of collaboratively flesh out this piece of writing.
Think like a startup, act like a mature business. It's the trick that publishing houses around the world want to master. Neil DeYoung is executive director of Hachette Digital Incorporated, where he is responsible for managing digital content development and operations, including for interactive ebooks and direct-to-consumer e-commerce. In 2016, trade book publishing relies less and less on the trade and more on developing closer relationships with readers. To get there often requires publishing practices that emulate software development. DeYoung told me more when we met last summer at the Yale Publishing Course, where we both were guest lecturers.
Neil DeYoung, you gave the attendees here today instructions on how to approach publishing. It sounded to me in the back of the room much more like a software developer than what we traditionally think of as a publisher. Do I have that right?
Yeah, definitely. Being able to develop in a hyper-release schedule is really difficult when you're looking at interactive development or digital development at all. So adapting a software development philosophy is really important to be able to release things and iterate content in a way that makes sense in what consumers are looking for.
So for listeners, hyper-release, it sounds like something on Star Trek, but what you mean, I assume, is that kind of agile software development approach of scrums and sort of revision and retakes and evolution along the way, not sort of trying to get to a perfect result.
That's definitely part of it. What I was actually referring to in hyper-release schedule is that for book publishers, we release content on a weekly basis, right? We have a single title, multiple titles per week. Our marketing publicity departments need to concentrate on the title and then also concentrate on the next title that's releasing the next week. So our time is often spent on managing titles that on a weekly basis that we're releasing all the time, which leaves very little time to work on things that are outside of the box.
Okay, so that's really the point then. You've got multiple timelines to manage here, and they're all sort of stacked on top of each other. That must be quite a feat.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And one of the things that we had to do was be upfront about the schedule, and that in order to do what we need to do, we have to operate a different timeline. And that means addressing our schedule in different ways and the types of titles that we're going to work on. Obviously, working on front list titles when you're doing something like that and it requires agile development is much harder. Working on backlist titles, you know, allows us to do those freedom in the schedule that we wouldn't have on the front list. Both approaches have pros and cons, and we weigh each one for each project. But either way, it's still true that we have a certain period of time where we can do development, and then we have what we call a blackout period. You know, that blackout period is meant to take a look back at what we've just done. What do we need to improve on? What tools can we create that can help us scale what we've done for future projects? Things like that. You need time to take that pause and evaluate what you've done and iterate on what you've released so that you're providing fresh content and features.
If I was going to pick the place that's the most important on the schedule, it sounds like that blackout period may be the most important part.
It's just like my children. I love them all. Not one point of the schedule is more important than the other. You can't have a successful program without having both periods, that development period and that pause blackout period. If you don't have that, your content and your feature set becomes stale. And when you become stale, that's usually the death of your digital publishing program.
From a resplendent summer's day on the Ivy League campus of Yale in New England, I traveled south in late fall to the Miami Book Fair, the largest event on the national publishing calendar that is open to the general public. For a weekend in November, the campus at Miami-Dade College becomes a hive for readers of all ages and in many languages. At Beyond the Book, we try to explore new territories in writing and reading that make use of technology, the product of human imagination and invention. It's a remarkable journey that began 8,000 years ago when Sumerians etched the first pictographs in moist clay with a sharpened reed stylus. Today, digital technology makes reading and writing possible, of course, as well as the sharing of that self-expression to a global audience. We read books, we probably always will, and we will read on a smartphone or a laptop or an e-reader, whichever is the most convenient and most available. The rise of these devices presents a fascinating, perplexing challenge for reading and for books. All at once, the book moves from the printed page to a screen, placing it next to each and every other media. Kristen McLean is Director of New Business Development at Nielsen Book, part of Nielsen Entertainment. She's a 20-year veteran of the publishing industry and lectures extensively on issues facing the publishing world, including the effect of technology and culture on books and reading, and the role of bookstores and libraries in the lives of 21st century readers. She was eager to dispel for our Miami Book Fair audience the technophile myth that print is dead.
I've always been a big fan of print, and I think to be a futurist right now is to be a fan of print, because what we've seen is that certainly digital came in around 2007, 2008, and really started to disrupt things in the publishing market in 2010, 2011. But it didn't quite have the meteoric growth that everyone was expecting, and the people there was a couple examples of libraries that very quickly got rid of all of their books in favor of digital have been proven to be a little bit hasty. We've seen in the last couple of years that ebook sales are down generally and print book sales are up. And right now ebooks are about overall 20% of the U.S. book market, but that's a bit of a tricky number because in certain categories like romance, ebooks are up about 50%, whereas in categories like kids' books, they're down like around 10% and going down in most categories except for perhaps romance and mystery.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons for that, and we'll talk about that. But it's important to stress, I think, that among the factors, the business factors, the role that the publishers have played in their own decisions, consumers have made a choice here. They've returned to print. Would you say that's true?
I think that's true. I think that I think there's a couple things going on there. The first is that I think that the shininess of ebooks has sort of worn off a little bit, and people have made some choices for themselves that in a certain number of cases they want to go back to print because they prefer the experience. I think that, and maybe Andrew's going to talk about this, there's some business issues behind that also. I think that the publishing industry has gone through some legal challenges to ebook pricing, where publishers wanted to keep the prices a little higher. Amazon wanted to keep the prices as low as possible, and then we have self-publishers in there who are able to set extremely low prices for their self-published ebooks. So it's created a bit of a Wild West in the digital space also. And so, I don't know for sure whether or not e is slowing down because now publishers have gone back to setting some higher prices for their ebooks. But I do think it's sort of a combination of all these things. And when ebooks, one of the big surprises initially with ebooks is when they first came out, we assumed that we were going to see, for instance, teens picking up ebooks in really great numbers. And one of the first indicators that we had that maybe our assumptions about that were wrong was early research that we did that found that actually, in fact, teens did not like ebooks and had a very strong preference for print and have continued to have a very strong preference for print. And what that taught us right away is the fact that, of course, right, our assumptions about ebooks as a technology really ran headlong into teens, that for them books are an identity factor, number one. Number two, they don't necessarily want to spend the money on ebooks.
In 2016, we dearly love our gadgets and all the very latest apps, yet there remains room in our hearts for old friends. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, with subsidiaries RightsDirect in the Netherlands and Ixis in the United Kingdom. CCC is a global leader in content workflow, document delivery, text and data mining, and rights licensing technology. Beyond the Book co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Background music for this podcast provided by CCC's RightFind Music. Learn more at copyright.com/music. I'm Christopher Keneally. Join us again soon on Beyond the Book.